You can't know what X is in heaven unless you know what X is. So you can't know what sex is in heaven unless you know what sex is. We can't know what in heaven's name sex is unless we know what on earth sex is. Well, haven't we been thinking about that for a long time? Don't we know? What else dominates our fantasies, waking and sleeping 24 hours a day, nose to the grindstone? What else fills our TV shows, novels, plays, gossip columns, self-help books, and psychologies but sex? 15 years or so ago, when the Volkswagen Corporation was going belly up and the bug wasn't selling anymore, they tried a new advertising technique. They told the truth. There was a commercial, a famous commercial, that had nothing but black newsprint on a white background. Everything was scientifically proved. They proved that the Volkswagen bug was the best buy anybody could possibly make through frequency of repair records, financial statements, authorities, etc. It was a commercial that made me go out and say, okay, I'm going to buy one. It was the least successful commercial in the history of the world. The bug died because of that commercial. Next year, they employed girls with bikinis, and the sales went up. Sex sells everything. So, aren't we thinking too much about sex? Nope. I think we're thinking too little about sex. I think we think hardly at all about it. We dream about it. We fantasize about it. Feel, experiment, yeah, but honest, look it in the face, thinking, hardly ever. What other subject in the world is there about which there is more heat and less light? And therefore, I, as a philosopher, want to begin with four dull but important abstract philosophical principles about the metaphysical essence of sex. I think these four principles are absolutely necessary for sanity about sex on earth and therefore sex in heaven. And those two topics are going to be much more closely connected than we might think. There's thousands of books about sex, many how-to-do-it books on the subject. That doesn't mean that we know. It means the opposite. It's when everybody's pipes are leaking that people buy books on plumbing. My four philosophical principles might seem very strange or even shocking to some of you. Yet I think they are far from original. They're simply the primeval platitudes that were known to most pre-modern societies. They are the sane, sunny country of sexual common sense, if you include the democracy of the dead. That is, if you take a vote of your ancestors as well. Yet, in another way, they are radical. Radical comes from the Greek word radix, which means root, and these go to the root of what sex means. And I think our uprooted society is rooting around looking for substitutes like a pig rooting for truffles, and it's not found them. So here are four beginning principles. Principle one, sex is something that you are, not first of all that you do. What does that mean? Well, imagine you go into a bookstore and you see a book with a racy sounding title, The Sexual Life of a Nun. You probably assume it was some scurrilous, gossipy sort of story about tunnels connecting convents and monasteries and clandestine rendezvous behind the high altar and masking a pregnancy as a tumor. Nope. It's a perfectly proper title. All nuns have a sexual life. They are women, not men. When a nun prays, she prays. When a nun acts charitably, she, not he, acts charitably. Her vow of celibacy forbids sexual intercourse, but it cannot forbid her to be a woman. In everything that she does, her essence plays a part. And even if she never sees a man and is confined to a contemplative monastery all her life, her sex remains a part of her essence, just as does her age and her race and her sense of humor. Of course a nun has sex. She is female. The counterfeit phrase, having sex, meaning sexual intercourse or copulation, this counterfeit was minted only recently. Draftees sometimes filled in the box on their induction form, labeled sex, not with the word male, but occasionally or please. The joke would have been unintelligible to previous generations. The significance of the linguistic change is that we have trivialized sex into a thing to do rather than a quality of our being. It has become a thing of surfaces and feelings rather than personality and internal feeling. So that we call even masturbation having sex. Though, of course, it's exactly the opposite. It's a substitute for a real relationship with the real other sex. The words masculinity and femininity do not mean the same thing as maleness and femaleness. Masculinity and femininity mean something more than the biological. But our society has reduced these things from archetypes to stereotypes. From Platonic ideas like yin and yang to cultural roles like Blondie and Dagwood or George and Gracie. Traditional expectations that men be men and women be women are confused because we no longer know what to expect men and women to be. But even though our heads are confused, I think our hearts still beat with those expectations. Even if our minds reject the old stereotypes, our hearts long for them. And the reason is that even the old stereotypes were closer to our innate sexual instincts than the new unisex stereotypes. In other words, we have sexist hearts even while we have unisex heads. I will give evidence for this claim. It's empirical, it's controversial, but it's empirical. More people are attracted to the old stereotypes than to the new ones. Romeos still want to marry Juliets, especially when you factor in race. Statistically, many, many more white women marry black men than white men marrying black women, and many more Western men marry Asian women than Western women marrying Asian men. Now, why is that? Because white women perceive black men as sexy, as studs, as masculine, not as wimps. And white men perceive Asian women as sexy, that is, feminine, sweet, not bitchy. That's the perception. Women want two things in every culture. A woman wants two things in a man. Somebody who's strong and gentle. A gentle man, not a gentle wimp. Poor Woody Allen and Alan Alda don't know what that means anymore. I don't push the old stereotypes. They're silly. They had faults. Then the main fault, I think, was their much too tight connection between sexual being and sexual doing. Their tying of sexual identity to sexual roles, especially for women. The old feeling that it was somehow unfeminine for a woman to be a doctor or a lawyer or a politician or even a great left-handed relief pitcher. Welcome to the tryouts, if you like. But the antidote to this illness is not to confuse sexual identities, but to locate them in your being rather than in your doing. And in that way, you can soften up your social roles without softening up your sexual identity. In fact, a man who is confident of his inner masculinity is much more likely to share in traditionally female activities like housework and baby care than a man who ties his sexuality to his social role. So if our first principle is accepted, if sexuality is part of our inner essence, then it follows that there is sexuality in heaven, because your essence is not negated in heaven. Whether or not you have sex, that is, copulate in heaven, and whether or not we have sexually distinct social roles in heaven, the more important question is, are we complete human beings in heaven? Yes, we don't get castrated or neutered. Second principle. The alternative to sexual chauvinism is not sexual egalitarianism. The two most popular philosophies of sexuality today seem totally opposed to each other, yet at the most basic level, they are in agreement and equally mistaken. They could be called chauvinism and egalitarianism. Each has an argument. The argument is in the form of a syllogism with three propositions. Let me label them A, B, and C. Chauvinism starts with the premise that one sex is superior to the other. This is usually the male, but there are also some strident female chauvinist voices in our current cacophony. To say that is almost necessarily to say B, namely, that the sexes are different. Because for one thing to be superior to another, it has to be different. Therefore, they are different by nature and not just by social convention. So, chauvinism accepts A and B. Egalitarianism tries to disagree with A totally. It passionately disagrees with superiority. It thinks that to do so, it has to disagree with B also. So, chauvinism says the two sexes are by nature different, and therefore one is superior to the other. The egalitarian says wrong on both counts. So there's nothing common to those two arguments, right? Wrong. What's common to both arguments is the hidden premise C, that all differences are differences in value. Once that common premise is smoked out, it's easy to see how wrong both arguments are. Because here's a half-truth. One of the two premises of the chauvinist is right. One of the two premises of the egalitarian is right. But the other premise of both arguments is wrong, and it's the same premise. Of course not all differences are differences in value. Are cats better than dogs? Are dogs better than cats? Or are they different only by social convention and not by nature? Both chauvinists and egalitarians should read the poets, the songwriters, and the mythmakers to find a third philosophy of sexuality that is both more sane and more interesting, that denies neither the obvious rational truth that the sexes are equal in value, the thing the chauvinist denies, nor the equally obvious instinctive truth that the egalitarian denies, that the two sexes are innately different. This older philosophy revels in both and in their difference. Vive la différence. It believes that men are superior at being men and women are superior at being women. So let's apply this to heaven now. If sexual differences are natural, then they are preserved in heaven because grace does not destroy nature but perfects it. The God who created us does not want to destroy us. If, on the other hand, sexual differences are only humanly and socially conventional, then heaven will remove them, as it will remove economics and jurisprudence and military science and politics. Not many of us have job security after death. That's why I'm a philosopher. Because all those things came after the fall and because of the fall. But sexuality came as God's original package. His first command, remember, before the fall was, be fruitful and multiply. I don't think he meant grow oranges and invent calculators. For some reason or other, most non-Christians think that the fall had something to do with sex. They haven't read Genesis. God may unmake a lot of the stuff that we make. He might tear down Fenway Park. But he does not unmake what he makes, because he makes no mistakes. Christians who are sexual egalitarians always quote one verse in the Bible to prove their supposed truth, namely St. Paul's statement, in Christ there is neither male nor female. But that statement does not mean there's no sex in heaven. First of all, it refers not just to heaven, but primarily to earth. We're in Christ now. In fact, if we're not in Christ now, then there's no hope of heaven for us. But we are male or female now. Paul's point is that our sex does not determine our in-Christness. God is an equal opportunity employer. But he employs the men and women he created, not the neuters of our imagination or ideology. Principle 3. Sex is spiritual. Spiritual does not mean vaguely pious, ethereal, and idealistic. If that's what spiritual means, Christianity is certainly not spiritual. And spiritual does not mean, either, wholly immaterial or non-material. If that's what it means, Christianity is not spiritual either. Christianity is not a spiritual religion. Christianity is for human beings, not for angels. We are neither angels nor animals. Nor are we angels trapped in alien animal bodies. As Plato seemed to think. The last thing Socrates said at his deathbed was a joke that was based on that philosophy. He said, we owe a cock to Asclepius. A cock, a rooster, was the thank offering that pious Greeks made to the god Asclepius, who was the god of healing. When they were rescued from a life-threatening disease, in a thank offering, they would offer a sheep if they were rich or a rooster if they were poor to the god of healing. Well, Socrates was never sick a day in his life. It was a joke. He's being delivered from the disease of the body. Socrates was a secular saint, but he certainly wasn't a Christian. He had the wrong notion of the human body. No, we are not ghosts trapped in machines. We are two-dimensional creatures. We are physical in our very thought processes, because brains are just as physical as wombs or penises. And our very wombs and penises are spiritual parts of our personal identity and meaning. We love to separate those two things, but that's like separating the number of syllables in Hamlet and the philosophical meaning of Hamlet. You can't. So what does spiritual mean? Well, spiritual means it's in the spirit or soul or psyche and not merely the body. It means that sex is between the ears before it's between the legs. In other words, we have sexual souls. Now, if sex is masculinity and femininity, that means there's masculinity and femininity in souls. There are masculine souls and feminine souls. Now, many people are shocked at that notion. They not only disagree, the idea seems utterly crude, superstitious, barbaric, repugnant, primitive, and incredible. Why? Well, I think we can answer that question only by first answering the opposite one. Why does the idea seem so reasonable and enlightened to me? Because I think it's the only alternative to either materialism, wrong spiritualism, or dualism. If you're a spiritualist, like a Buddhist or a Christian Scientist, you believe matter's an illusion. Everything's spirit. I had a friend who taught physical chemistry at an Ivy League college. He was a Christian Scientist. I asked him once how he could teach physical chemistry if he believed matter was an illusion. And he said, well, I begin my class with, I am a Christian Scientist and my religion tells me that matter does not exist. Nevertheless, this dream is astonishingly consistent and I shall now give you its properties. He also told me my favorite Christian Science joke. The old Christian Science boy came up to his Christian Science minister and said, preacher, please pray for my daddy. He's sick. Boy, you don't understand our faith. Sickness is an illusion. You go tell your daddy he only thinks he's sick. Oh, thank you. Next day, he sees the boy. Hey, boy, how's your daddy? Oh, he thinks he's dead. That's cruel, but it's funny. So much for spiritualism. If at the opposite extreme you're a materialist, then there simply is no soul. So sex can't be a quality of the soul. But if there's no soul, then it's matter that thinks. How can matter be either right or wrong? Materialism is an ism. It's a thought. It contradicts itself. Third mistake. If you're a dualist, if you split body and soul completely, if you see a person as a ghost trapped in a machine, then one half of the person can be totally different from the other. The body can be sexual without the soul being sexual. I think that's how most of us think. When you think of your soul leaving your body, you don't think of anything masculine or feminine leaving your body, do you? Well, I think you should. If you think you're a ghost in a machine, then only the material part is sexed and the spiritual part isn't. So you're thinking that the machine has sex and the ghost doesn't. That's the exact opposite of the truth. Ghosts were once persons, so they have a sexual identity from their personalities, their souls. Machines don't. I don't think anybody who knows anything about empirical psychology can possibly be a Cartesian dualist. The ghost and the machine thing. The evidence for the psychosomatic unity is overwhelming. You don't even have to be a psychologist. It's just commonsensical. We find no pervasive feature of either our body or our soul that's insulated from the other. Every sound in the soul has strong echoes in the body, and every sound in the body has strong echoes in the soul. So, I'm going to argue for the conclusion of sexual souls, and let premise one be the psychosomatic unity. Psyche is the word for soul, soma is the word for body. Psychosomatic unity means that soul and body aren't two things, but two aspects or dimensions of one thing, us. Premise two is the even more obvious fact that biological sexuality is innate and natural. Somatic, biological, bodily sex is innate. It's not conditioned, conventional, socially artificial. In fact, it's pervasive to every cell in the body. The inevitable conclusion from these two premises is that sexuality is innate and natural and pervasive to the whole person, soul as well as body. The only way to avoid the conclusion is to deny one of the two premises, to deny the psychosomatic unity or innate somatic sexuality. Well, in the light of this very simple argument, why is the conclusion not only unfamiliar but shocking to so many people in our society? I can think of only two reasons. The first is a misunderstanding, the second a serious mistake. The first reason would be an overreaction to what is seen as monosexual soul stereotyping. A wholly masculine soul, whatever that means, or a wholly feminine soul, sounds unreal and oversimplified. And it is. But that's not what sexual souls implies. Rather, in every soul, there is what Jung calls anima and animus, femininity and masculinity. Just as in the body, one sex predominates, but the other is also present. Both hormones are present, but in a different relationship. If the dominant sex of the soul is not the same as the dominant sex of the body, then that person is a sexual misfit, and perhaps a candidate for a sex change operation of body or of soul, either on earth or in heaven. Perhaps heaven supplies such changes, just as it supplies all other needed forms of healing. By the way, I've used the word sex in the way that most people today use the word gender. I don't use the currently fashionable word gender because I think it's a confusion and an insult. A confusion between words and persons. Gender used to be, for hundreds of years, a quality of nouns, of persons. Sex was a quality of persons. Then, after the 60s, we started to use sex to mean something you do and not something you are, and that was one insult. So we need another word to express something you are, so we borrowed it from grammar. That's a second insult. In any case, whatever happens in heaven, our resurrection bodies are going to perfectly express our souls. And since our souls are innately sexual, our bodies will perfectly express our soul's true sexual identity. A second and more serious reason why some people think there can't possibly be sexual souls is that they misunderstand what it means to speak of a soul or a spirit or anything more than matter. They are really pantheists. They think that spirit is a kind of undifferentiated, infinite everything and nothing. They think of spirit as simply leaving behind all the sharp distinctions that exist in the body and in matter. That's not the Christian notion of spirit. But you say, spirit is, in a sense, infinite in relation to matter, isn't it? Yep. There's no limit to what ideas your mind can hold, though there is a limit to the number of molecules that fit in your brain. There's no limit to the number of things you can send your spirit out to love, but there certainly is a limit to anything material. But infinity does not mean everything and nothing. Is God the blob? God is infinite. What does that mean? God is nothing in particular? He has no character? If so, you better stop praying. You don't pray to a blob. God's infinity means that each of his very definite and positive attributes, which constitute his personality, is unlimited. He's unlimited love, but he's not hate or indifference. He's unlimited wisdom. He's not stupidity or folly. He's unlimited power. He's not weakness. He's unlimited justice. He's not injustice. He's unlimited faithfulness. He's not Rhett Butler. Spirit is no less differentiated and articulated and structured and specified and determined and sharp and formed than matter is. The opposite. Your own spirit can suffer far more and rejoice far more, more delicately, more exquisitely, and in a far greater variety of ways than your body can. There's empirical proof of that. What happens when you despair enormously in your spirit? Well, two things you often do is you pull your hair out and you smash your head against the wall. Why in the world do you do that? Why do you cause yourself physical pain? You've already got spiritual pain. Very simple. Physical pain isn't as bad. It's a distraction. It's a diversion. Well, if your spirit can do all sorts of things that your body can't, it's got to be more complex than the body. That's why psychology is not an exact science as anatomy is. So my principle is that differentiation increases as spirituality increases. Differences in general, and sexual differences in particular, increase rather than decrease as you move up the cosmic hierarchy. Yes, there is a cosmic hierarchy, unless you can honestly believe that oysters have as much right to eat you as you have to eat them. So angels are superior to us in differentiation, as superior as we are to animals. And God is infinitely specific, infinitely differentiated, because he is the author of all differences, all forms. If you look at the creation story very carefully, you'll note that every act of creation is an act of differentiation, of discrimination. Light from darkness, land from sea, animals from plants, and so on. Creating is forming, and forming is differentiating. Now, there's two philosophies that can't believe in creation, materialism and pantheism. Materialism believes that all differences in form are ultimately illusory appearances, that the only root reality is matter. Everything's just stuff. And pantheism also believes that differences in form are ultimately illusory. The only root reality is the one universal spirit. But theism believes that form is real because God created it. So whatever positive reality is there in the creation must have its model in the creator. So it follows that we will ultimately have to predicate sexuality in some way of God himself. But that will take some explaining. I'll give you that in a minute. Let's add now our fourth principle, that sex is cosmic throughout the cosmos. That might seem just as strange to you as the other three. Why do I say that? Well, let's look at language for one thing. Have you ever wondered why almost all languages except English attribute sexuality to things? They have masculine and feminine nouns. English is almost the only language in the history of the world that doesn't. And the apportioning out of masculinity and femininity is strangely consistent. Trees, rocks, ships, stars, horns, kettles, fate, flowers, waves. These things, not just men and women, are called masculine or feminine. Now, why is that? Well, you probably assumed unthinkingly that this was, of course, a mere projection and personification, a reading of human sexuality into nature, a personifying of nature. Couldn't it be the other? Couldn't it be reading nature's own sexuality out of herself? Notice I said herself, not itself. Did it ever occur to you that it just might be that human sexuality is derived from a cosmic principle rather than vice versa? That we are a local application of a universal principle? That we fit the universe? That the universe is not a machine, but more like a mother? We're not freaks. What we are, everything else also is, in different ways and in different degrees. We are, as the medieval said, a microcosm, a little cosmos. And the universe is the macrocosm, the large cosmos, and we fit. We're more like little fish inside bigger fish than we are like sardines in an alien can. It's the machine universe that is the projection, not the human universe. The real universe is more like a human being than it is like a machine. That sounds like a shocking conclusion. I'll prove it. Premise one, the universe means nature. Premise two, nature is certainly natural if anything is. Premise three, we too are natural, and machines are not natural. Therefore, the universe is more like a human being than it is like a machine. If I had time, I'd apply this idea to other aspects of our being. I'd talk about the cosmic extension of something analogous to consciousness and volition everywhere, animals, plants, subatomic particles. It's, of course, a significant difference. A ladder has many really distinct rungs, but it also has a unity. It's one ladder. And we call it a universe. Unity and diversity in the same thing. But we don't have time to apply that to anything except sexuality here. So let's do that. Sexuality must in some way go all the way up and all the way down the cosmic ladder or hierarchy. All the way down, what could that mean? Well, it means love among the particles. It means gravitational and electromagnetic attraction. To use a primitive, old-fashioned, but simple image, Here's our little hydrogen atom with one little electron that just knows the difference between her proton, whom she loves, and that other electron who is her rival. Because if she didn't know the difference, she wouldn't behave so knowingly. What does she do? She orbits around her proton and repels other electrons, never vice versa. Oh, but you say, that's a poetic way of saying it. The real reason is because of the balance resultant between two merely physical forces, angular momentum. She's moving that way. So that's the only force that were there. Then it would zoom her out of orbit. But that's exactly balanced by bipolar electromagnetic attraction between the negative and positive charges, which, if that were the only force, there'd be fusion that would zap her right down into her proton. So our little electron has just too much zoom for a zap and just too much zap for a zoom, so she's got a stable orbit. That's right, except for one word. You say, this is the resultant of two merely physical forces. How dare you call physical forces mere? And how do you account for the second of those two forces? Why is there this attraction between positive and negative charges? It is exactly as mysterious as love. In fact, it is love. It's love among the particles. It's the love that moves the sun and all the stars. Dante knew it. We've forgotten. Our scientists can tell you how it works much better than Dante, but only the lover knows why. So if sex goes down to the bottom, does it also go up to the top? Well, of course. I've said that spirit is no less sexual than matter. I've said that all qualities and contrasts are richer and sharper and more real as we rise closer and closer to the archetype of all realness, God. The God of the Bible is not some pantheistic pudding in which all differences are reduced to lumps in the tapioca. He's a light, but he doesn't outdazzle the finite lights and colors. So God is the most sexual of all beings. This sounds shocking to you only if you see sex merely as physical and not spiritual, or maybe if you're a Unitarian rather than a Trinitarian. Because the love relationship between the Father and the Son within the Trinity, the relationship from which the Holy Spirit eternally proceeds, is a supersexual relationship. It is like the human sexual relationship from which a child proceeds in time. Or rather, that human relationship is a little bit like the divine one. The Bible calls sexuality the image of God, Genesis 1:27. And God created mankind, humanity in general, in his own image, male and female. Well, for B to be the image of A must in some way have all the qualities that are imaged by B. So God must be a sexual being, not in a weaker but a stronger sense that we are. And therefore, there must be sex in heaven, because in heaven we're closer to the source of all sex. As we climb Jacob's ladder, the angels look less like neutered greeting card cherubs and more like Mars and Venus. Another reason that we will be more sexual in heaven rather than less is that all earthly perversions of true sexuality will be overcome in heaven, especially the master perversion, selfishness. That perversion messes up everything in our lives, not just sexuality. To make yourself into God, to desire selfish pleasure as your greatest good, that's not only to miss God, but also to miss pleasure and sexual pleasure. Jesus didn't merely say, seek ye first the kingdom of God. He also added, and then all these other things will be added unto you. When we put first things first, second things flourish. Each story of the building fits better when the foundation is put first. C.S. Lewis calls this the principle of first and second things. In any area of life, putting second things first loses not only the first things, but also the second things. Become an alcoholic and you lose the proper pleasure of alcohol, which according to the Bible, God designed and invented to gladden the heart of man. Too bad so many people use it to sadden rather than to gladden. So to treat pleasure as God is to miss not only God, but pleasure. And to treat sexual pleasure as God is to miss out not only on God, but also sexual pleasure. The highest pleasure always comes from self-forgetfulness. The self always spoils its own pleasure. Pleasure's like light. If you grab at it, you miss it. If you try to bottle it, you get only darkness. But if you let it pass through you, you can catch the glory. The self has a built-in God-imaging design of self-fulfillment by self-forgetfulness, pleasure through unselfishness, ecstasy by standing outside yourself. That's what the word ecstasy literally means. I don't mean the self-conscious sacrifice of the do-gooder. I mean the spontaneous, unconscious generosity of the lover. Even this unselfishness can be mocked and imaged. I love C.S. Lewis's inscription on a gravestone. Erected by her sorrowing brothers in memory of Martha Clay, here lies one who lived for others. Now she has rest, and so have they. That's not what I mean. But for every perversion, there's a version that is the perversion of. Now, this principle that the greatest pleasure is in self-giving is graphically illustrated by sexual intercourse. And in fact, by the very structure of the sexual organs, which must give themselves up to each other in order to be fulfilled. So in heaven, where egotistic perversions are totally eliminated, all pleasure will be increased, including sexual pleasure. Now, whether that will include physical sexual pleasure and physical sexual intercourse or not remains to be seen. So now it is time for us to apply our four principles to the question of sex in heaven. In the most important and obvious sense, we've seen that there certainly is sex in heaven simply because there are human beings there. We've seen that sexuality is like race rather than cosmetics. It's an essential aspect of your identity, spiritual as well as physical. And even if sex were not spiritual, there'd be sex in heaven because of the resurrection of the body. The body is not a mistake to be unmade or a prison cell to be freed from, but a divine work of art designed to show forth the soul, just as the human soul is designed to show forth the glory of God in a kind of a splendor and overflow of generous superfluity. The philosopher Wittgenstein said, "The only adequate image of the human soul is the human body, especially the face." All right, but is there sexual intercourse in heaven? If we will have bodily sex organs, and if we're not going to be castrated, what do we use them for in heaven? Well, not baby making. Earth is the breeding colony. Heaven is the homeland. Not marriage. Christ's words to the Sadducees in Matthew 22 are pretty clear about that. In regard to marriage, we are like the angels. Notice it's not said we're like the angels in any other ways, such as lacking physical bodies. Might there be, though, another activity in which baby-making and marriage are taken up, swallowed up, or transformed? I think it's reasonable to suppose that. Everything on earth is analogous to something in heaven. Heaven neither simply removes nor simply continues earthly things. If that's true, and if we apply that principle to our question about sexual intercourse in heaven, we get the conclusion that perhaps intercourse on earth is a shadow or symbol of something in heaven. Now, what might that be? It could be spiritual intercourse. And remember, that includes sexual intercourse because sex is spiritual. That might mean, I think it would mean, something more specific than just universal charity. It would be special communion with the sexually complementary, something a man can have only with a woman and a woman only with a man. We're made complete by such a union. God himself said, "It is not good that the man should be alone." And I don't think God simply rips up his design for human fulfillment. Now, that relationship may or may not be confined to one person in heaven. Monogamy may be only for earth. I don't know. I'm just opening minds to possibilities. On earth, our bodies are private. In heaven, I think we will share each other's secrets without shame, as we cannot do on earth. So perhaps in the communion of saints, promiscuity of the spirit will be a virtue. Now, this relationship may or may not extend to all persons of the opposite sex. I don't think it could do that in the same way or degree. And if it did extend to all, it would treat each differently simply because each is different, sexually as well as in other ways. Just as Jesus loved all his disciples, but he certainly didn't love James in the same way that he loved John, or John in the same way that he loved Judas. Perhaps there are special kindred souls in heaven that we are designed to feel a special sexual love for. That might be the heavenly solution to the earthly riddle of why in the world John falls for Mary, of all people, and not for Jane. And why romantic lovers feel their love is fated and in the stars and made in heaven. Well, that doesn't quite make sense on earth, but maybe it does in heaven. But this would certainly differ from romantic love on earth in that it would be free and not driven. It would flow from the soul to the body, not from the body to the soul. Nor would it ever feel apart from or opposed to the relationship with God. But it would be a part of it or a consequence of it. It would flow from it. It would be his design, his art, the wave of his baton. It would also be totally unselfconscious and unselfish. So it would be the ethical goodness of agape love joined to the passion of erotic love. It would be agape without an external abstract law and duty, and it would be eros without any selfishness or being driven by animal drives. Does that mean it would take the form of physical sexual intercourse? Well, that's the question you probably interpreted my title to mean, so let's explore it. Not to kowtow to a sexual monomania, but because it's an honest question. Actually, you know, I think I became a philosopher because first day I was on campus in college, there was an upperclassman there arguing theology, and he was arguing about the question whether Adam and Eve farted before the fall. And I thought he was joking, and he wasn't. He was serious. He wanted to know. Well, about 4 o'clock the next morning, we finally decided that in order to answer the question yes or no, we'd have to know how literally to take the Genesis account, how historical the fall was, how much we resembled and didn't resemble Adam and Eve, whether an unfallen person would have any possibility of saying, ugh, yucky, whether there are aesthetic value judgments which were objective or not, whether this was all predestined or whether it was free will. We got into almost every problem of theology from the question of whether Adam farted before the fall. This made me fall in love with philosophical questions. So if you think the question we're pursuing now is a little weird and pushy, I don't. I grant that most theologians wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pen, but that's because abstract questions are always safer than concrete questions. I like concrete questions. Well, since there are bodies in heaven which are able to eat and to be touched, Christ's resurrection body is the only data we have about heavenly bodies, I think it's quite certain that there will be the possibility of physical intercourse. But the question is, would that possibility be actualized? I don't know, but here are some principles for deciding. A thing will be actualized in heaven only if it serves a good purpose, right? What are the possible purposes and meanings of sexual intercourse? Let's try to read all the clues in earthly sexual intercourse. I see three levels of meaning: the subhuman or animal, the specifically human, and the superhuman or divine. I see two animal reasons for intercourse. One is the conscious drive for pleasure, and the second is the unconscious drive to perpetuate the species. I think both of these would be absent in heaven, although they are present on earth. We are animals. We're rational animals. We're animals. I think they're absent in heaven because although there certainly are unimaginably great pleasures in heaven, we're told that in Scripture, we're not driven by them. They're not animal instincts. And secondly, you don't need to perpetuate the species because the human species is complete in eternity. That's why there's no private marriage. Well, let's go up to superhuman reasons for intercourse. I see two of these. One is bad, one is good. The bad one is idolatry, love of the beloved as a substitute for God. The other would be the romantic relationship, the Dante-Beatrice relationship, the love of the beloved as an image of God. Well, of course, there's no idolatry in heaven, no substitutes for God or even tempting when God himself is present. And as for the second, this is a very beautiful thing. The earthly beloved seen as a kind of window to God or a mirror reflecting the divine beauty. That's why the lover was so smitten. But now that the full reality of God is present, why would we stare at the little mirror? If the impulse to adore has found its perfect object, then no other object can rival it. Furthermore, even on earth, this purely romantic relationship leads not to sexual intercourse, but to infatuation and idealization. Dante neither desired nor enacted copulation with Beatrice. She was a work of art. So let's look at the specifically human reasons for sexual intercourse. I see two of these: consummating a monogamous marriage and the desire to express personal love. As to the first, there's no marriage in heaven. Christ said that. So we're left with the second. Well, let's explore that more deeply. I suspect there must be millions of more adequate ways to express love in heaven than the clumsy ecstasy of fitting two bodies together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Even the most satisfying earthly sexual intercourse cannot perfectly express all the love between the two parties. And the agony of wanting, yet not attaining, total intimacy with the beloved, wanting to get inside their soul as truly as you can get inside their body, the agony of that longing is one of the great ecstasies of romance. That sounds like a paradox, but any Red Sox fan understands how the greatest ecstasy can come from agony. In two senses, when the longing is fulfilled and when it's not. You appreciate anything more the longer you wait for it. And the fulfillment of a 86-year-long agony is really an ecstasy that nobody outside of Chicago can possibly understand. And secondly, the very agony of longing in itself is an ecstasy, which is why we love losers more than winners, including ourselves as lovers. Well, if the possibility of intercourse in heaven is not actualized, it would be for the same reason earthly lovers don't eat candy during intercourse. Candy's great, but there's something much better to do. So I think our question is a silly question. The question, will there be sexual intercourse in heaven, is like a little child's question, whether you can eat candy while you're having intercourse. That's a funny question from the adult's point of view, but not the child's. Candy is his greatest pleasure. How can he conceive a pleasure so intense that it renders candy irrelevant? But only if you know two things can you compare them. And everybody who has tasted both the delights of physical intercourse with the earthly beloved and the delights of spiritual intercourse with God, every single one testifies that there's simply no comparison. It's this spiritual intercourse with God that is the ecstasy that is imaged and hinted at in all earthly intercourse, physical or spiritual. And I think that's the ultimate reason why sexual passion is so strong and so different from other passions, so heavy with suggestions of profound meanings that always just elude our grasp. I don't think any practical need can account for it. I don't think any animal drive can explain it. No animal falls in love or writes profound romantic poetry or sees sex as a symbol of the ultimate meaning of life because no animal is made in the image of God. Not just sexuality, but human sexuality is that image. And human sexuality is a foretaste of that self-giving, that losing and finding the whole self, a foretaste of that oneness in manyness that is the very life of the Trinity and the joy of the Trinity. And that's what we long for without knowing it. That's why we tremble to stand outside of ourselves in the other. That's why we long to give our whole selves, body and soul, because we are images of God, the sexual being. We love the other sex because God loves God. And this earthly love is so passionate because heaven is full of passion, of energy and dynamism. That's one of the reasons God invented families. You can't love or hate anybody as much as your own family. Families are full of passion. Heaven is not boring or blasé. It is passionate because God is passionate. Jesus Christ, who is our window to God, was not a stoic or a scribe or a scholar. He was a lover. I think we correctly deny that God has passions in the passive sense. He is not moved or driven or conditioned by them as we are. He cannot fall in love for the same reason the ocean cannot get wet. He is love for the same reason a volcano can't get hot. But to think of the love that made the worlds, the love that became human and suffered alienation from itself and died to save us rebels, the love that gleamed through the fanatic joy of Jesus' obedience to the will of his Father, the love that shines in the eyes and lives of the saints, to think of this love as somehow less passionate than our little weak dribbles from that cataract, our temporary and tiny passions, this is a most disastrous fantasy. And that consuming love, that consuming fire, is our destined husband, according to his own promise. So, sex in heaven, indeed. And no pale, abstract, merely mental shadow of it either. It's earthly sex that's the shadow. And our earthly lives are a process of thickening so that we can share in the substance, becoming more like the heavenly fire so that we can endure more of the heavenly fire. At least that's what I think. What do you think? Time for questions. Yeah.
What is the nature of a female and what is the nature of a male? And as I recall, Wittgenstein also said, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent.
That's a question very much like, what is beauty? Philosophers have never come up with a very good answer to that. They can answer what is truth, what is love, what is justice, what is being, what is knowledge. It's very hard for them to deal with beauty. And within the realm of beauty, probably the two things that they find the hardest to understand are romantic love and music. So I'm not even going to go there. I'm going to give the answer that sounds very unphilosophical. We all know the answer to that question, but we can't put it into words.
I don't know about that.
Well, I'll explain a little more. It's an archetype. I think Plato was right. There are archetypes, but he's wrong in that they could all be clearly defined. In fact, the deeper the archetype, the harder it is to clearly define it. You can define a number very well. You can define a paperclip fairly well. You can define a rock fairly well. A cat's a lot harder. Human beings, much harder than that. So as you go up the hierarchy, it gets harder and harder. Well, when you get to things that are superior to yourself, that you bow down to, things like beauty, where you don't conquer them, you let them conquer you. It's very hard. So if a man wants to let the femininity of a woman, whatever that is, conquer him and fulfill him, and if a woman wants to let the masculinity of a man, whatever that is, conquer her and fulfill her, then they're both in this paradox. You've got to have experience to understand it. You've got to be within that relationship to understand it. Just as somebody with a tinny ear can't talk about music and someone with no poetic sense can't talk about poetry, someone without this sense of romance can't talk about romance. However, once you're inside it, it's very difficult to be outside of it at the same time. In fact, impossible. You can't define and experience the same thing at the same time. So you have to choose one or the other. You have to choose simply the instinctive, here it is, I'll make music of it, I'll give you an example of it, I'll write a story about it, I'll write poetry about it, or else you sit back and try to define it with a set of categories in a scientific way, and that's almost funny, even though it's accurate.
I guess what I was saying is that if that electron decided not to zoom or zam or whatever you call it, and decided to go in that direction, the northeast, then it should become a proton.
Yeah, but then it would be acting contrary to its own nature. Things have natures. Its nature is to be an electron. Here you can define love very easily. See, I'm glad you brought that up, because here's something clearly definable. The same thing on an animal level is much more mysterious. The same thing on a human level is much more mysterious. And on the divine level is the most mysterious of all. So my talk tonight is probably wild speculation, because I'm talking about God and heaven, and we're talking through our hats when we talk about that. But this is pretty clear. In the last couple of generations, physics has shown that even this simplest level, the physical, is much less clear than we thought and staggers our imagination. And not only is it not imagined, but probably not even imaginable. Nevertheless, we can approximate a pretty good definition. We can tell the difference between an electron and a proton. We can define it fairly well. We can predict their activity fairly well. There's not nearly as much mystery about electrons and protons as there is about men and women. So it should be fairly obvious that each thing has its own nature, and the nature of an electron is to be a negatively charged particle of some mysterious thing that we call matter. And a proton is to be a positively charged particle of this mysterious thing that we call matter. And the difference between the charges is almost as clear as the difference between zero and one. It's almost digital. So if that's true on the lowest level, if things have natures, and if we have to pervert or artificialize or violently impose something else upon their natures in order to make them act in a different way, for instance, you send another electron here, and that'll make this first electron wobble, maybe out of orbit, just as the love among every particle of matter and every other particle of matter that we call gravity which we can define very clearly in terms of an operational definition. All you need is the two variables of the mass and the distance. So the gravitational force is directly proportional to the mass and inversely proportional to the distance. So that's why this chalk falls. Unless I violently, externally, and artificially make the chalk act contrary to its nature by arresting its fall and maybe even forcing it to go upwards. However, I cannot habituate the chalk to act contrary to its nature. I might habituate a robin with a broken wing to fly, but I cannot habituate a piece of chalk to fly. I can make it fly over and over again contrary to its nature, but I cannot change its nature. There's a man who lives on some island off the coast of Washington who not only has pet rocks, but he tries to teach them to talk. And he's convinced that someday he will teach a rock to talk. That's a fascinating piece of insanity, but of course it's insanity. Some of us in Boston believe you cannot habituate the Red Sox to win the seventh game of a World Series, but that may be a false extension of the principle. A thing has a nature, and you can't make it act contrary to its nature except by violence. So, whatever is the nature of masculinity and femininity, also, you can make it act contrary to its nature, but only by perverting it, by something artificial. Now, social roles are always partly artificial and partly natural. They're never totally natural, they're never totally artificial, which is why it's good that they keep changing. And it's good that there's culture clash, because we sort of tend to sort out the bad and artificial roles and don't get hooked on them anymore. And then we try new ones, and we think, oh, this is great. And then after a few generations, we say, oh, gee, that's not so good after all. I saw a sad-looking woman on the street a couple of years ago with a large button. It said, victim of the sexual revolution. So that's not a clear answer to your question, but it's an answer to the question, why can't I give a clear answer to your question? Yeah.
So did Adam fart in heaven?
Before the fall.
What was your conclusion?
Our conclusion, surprisingly, was that it is somewhat probable that he did fart in the Garden of Eden, but will not fart in heaven. Because in the Garden of Eden, he did eat. And although there was no indigestion, still, it's physically possible for the pressure of gas to produce, to make wind. Maybe it was music. Maybe that was his wind instrument. Who knows? We can make beautiful music together. However, in heaven, if Jesus' resurrection body is our data about what kind of bodies we'll have in heaven, they don't need to eat. They can walk through walls, they can ascend to heaven, they can bilocate, they can go instantly to different places. They're not dependent upon the ingestion of organic substances.
But it's funny.
They can eat, but it doesn't have to. Yeah, of course it's funny.
But it's fun to eat, though.
Oh, okay. Jesus ate. On two occasions, he didn't have to, but he did, to prove that he wasn't a ghost. Remember in the upper room? And then again on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, once it was a fish and once it was, I think, a honeycomb. Ghosts can't eat.
So you still technically eat in heaven. Or
you can. I think sex is like that. We will have bodies that are real that can eat if they want to, but they don't have to. And I think they can have sexual intercourse if they want to, just as, you know, you can eat candy while you're having sex if you want to, but I don't think you will want to.